Welcome to radio at firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to The Apparatus Architect with Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur, and we are here live in sunny San Diego. And as compared to being in cloudy, rainy, and cold New York, this is a great place to be in February. So here's what we're going to be talking about on today's Apparatus Architect podcast. First up, we're going to talk about some recent, very serious apparatus accidents where, due to the fact that the crew was seated and belted, that while the apparatus was involved in a very serious incident, the crew safely walked away from it. And then we're going to be talking about some issues of things that impact our ability to use seat belts and some things that we're commonly doing in the fire service that really work against that safety effort. Going to follow that up with some discussion of the NFPA 1901 and the pending changes that are coming down the road that's going to impact a lot of different aspects of apparatus design. A few ideas that we'll discuss about how you can save money on your next pumper purchase. And then we're going to finish up with a little discussion about some other just current events that are occurring in the apparatus industry currently. So first up, I'm going to talk to Brother Mike. Some brothers and sister firefighters currently are walking around today on Earth and have the seat belts and the fact that they were seated and belted, have that to account for the fact that they're walking around today, even though they might be a little bit beat up. So would you like to fill us in on a couple of those incidents?
Sure. Thanks, Tom. Good day, everyone. The first event that we'd like to take you to was in British Columbia. It was a Mack MC model pumper going down the road, hit black ice, lost control, flipped over, what was in the news article numerous times. Everybody was belted and walked away. In a second event, we take you to San Antonio, Texas, where they had a firefighter fatality years ago with a firefighter falling out of the rig. In this event, one of their pumpers flipped over. Everybody on board was seated and belted in, preventing serious injury to those folks. And then finally, pictures that we just received last night in a December 23rd accident in Ontario, Canada. We had a Pierce Contender pumper that went off an embankment 40 feet down into a ravine and flipped over seven times. There were five crew members on board this Marathon, Ontario, Canada pumper, flipped over seven times, and everybody unbuckled and walked away. The only injury, well, Tom, were some cuts, and they were inflicted by loose equipment inside the cab. So maybe you could speak to that for us.
Yeah, there are several of things that we're doing currently in the fire service. Some of them impact apparatus design. Other things are, no matter how old or new your apparatus is, that we're modifying it and doing things in an unsafe manner within the crew compartment, no matter who built the vehicle. So when Mike mentions the make and brand of the apparatus that's involved in these accidents, this is happening, ladies and gentlemen, across the board. Doesn't make any difference who built the vehicle. Anything that you're operating in is certainly can and will be susceptible to an accident at some time. And it just raises the bar regarding the importance. When we say seated and belted, that should be go along the same line in the fire service parlance as hook and ladder. It's the two of them go together and should operate that way all of the time. As a result of the line of duty deaths, the statistics for the year recently concluded in 2007, 22.6% of the line of duty deaths occurred while we were responding or returning from alarms. We continue to be number two on that unfortunate list, hit parade list, right behind stress-related accidents and cardiac incidents. So it does cause us to pause a little bit to say, while we think that we've made some great strides with respect to the regulations and the standards that we have to design our vehicles to, while some of it might be attributable to local rules and regulations that might be state or local jurisdictional integrated into your department operations, or it could just be your department SOPs or SOGs, we're still not doing a very good job, candidly, in keeping our folks safe in the response mode and getting them back to the station. So the theme of the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation of Everyone Goes Home, last year there were a significant number of brother and sister firefighters. That's a nice tagline and a nice slogan, but it didn't happen to those folks. And Mike mentioned in the one incident where the people kind of survived the incident but were injured by mechanism with something that they came in contact with inside the cab. If we go back to the 1901 standards, Mike, they'll say that everything within the crew compartment needs to be retained in a 9G bracket, which there is bracketry that is commercially available that's built for fire service use and tested to fire service use that will enable you, for example, to take, if you wanted to carry, a flathead axe inside the cab so that it could be safely retained. And safely retained doesn't mean that we've built this little nice little brushed stainless steel pocket with a tulip clip, mounted it inside the cab door, and it's sitting in there. That might be good when the vehicle's running down the road and it's horizontal, but when something happens and the vehicle flips over, that little scabbard bracket and the tulip clip does not retain that flathead axe in its position. So it's things that we're bringing into the cab, or if we've designed the cab with a EMS compartment or a compartment to hold EMS gear and maybe have a hydro ram or a rabbit tool that we're going to throw in the base of that thing behind a roll-up door. And that's great as long as it's in the cabinet and behind the roll-up door. But I'll tell you, very commonly you'll see in career fire departments where it's a busy, heavy-running unit and they're going out the door 10 or 15 times a day, the guy's taking his favorite tool or his hand tools or his irons, and they're laying on the floor of the cab. And then it becomes a missile when the unit's not running down the road in the normal position. So that's one thing that happens. And I know, Mike, when a lot of times you go out and do a lot of teaching and instructing in the area of apparatus operations and apparatus placement. Is this something that you're seeing a lot of? Or how do people accept it when you counsel them and say, hey, I can appreciate the fact that you're having to come out of the cab with this tool 8 times a day, but if it's sitting on a floor in between your knees, that's not a safe place to be?
Tom, it's really becoming almost prevalent. It's a rarity to go to a firehouse and look at the apparatus and have everything within the cabin closure in 9G brackets or bolted down in some way. Specifically, we find flashlights, something as benign as a box of EMS gloves that could, in a rollover, really cut somebody up and create a serious injury. Other issues, radios, portable radios, find a lot of those. And then just the hand tools, the axes, the Halligans. And in one particular wreck years ago, they were going to an automatic alarm, and a firefighter had a Halligan on his lap, and that truck hit a tree after it lost its brakes, and that firefighter was pierced by a Halligan and later died. So it's extremely dangerous to have loose equipment inside the cab enclosure. And, you know, we try to counsel everybody that they need to adhere to the standard and to have some 9G bracketry. The reality is that we don't think an accident's going to happen to us, and yet there were over 50,000 emergency vehicle accidents last year. So it's happening to somebody, and we need to prepare for that.
The other thing, Mike, that I see, and it's nice to have apparatus staged if you're operating in a career fire department, so the gear is adjacent to the rig or maybe hanging on the door But something also that I've noticed, and again, this just reinforces the fact that people are not seated and belted when the apparatus maxi brake is released and the rig moves, is that we throw our gear up inside the cab. You know, bunker pants are maybe on the floor with a crew cab door open, and the coat and the helmet or whatever else we're putting on, that's sitting up inside or splayed out over the seat. So that's causing the vehicle to move, and we're standing up inside the cab possibly, or we're certainly not seated and belted, and we're trying to get geared up. A couple weeks ago in Prince George's County, Maryland, a volunteer firefighter was injured, but fortunately not seriously, when he fell out the door of a four-door enclosed cab when it was going around a corner, because he was putting his gear on or adjusting, you know, his gear up, and fell out of the cab onto the public highway, and fortunately was not run over. While he was injured, he's not seriously injured. I believe he was released the next day. But that goes again, that's an attitudinal thing. We sometimes think that this isn't going to happen to us, or once we put that turnout gear on, I find that in my own experience that I call it the Batman and Robin syndrome, is you've just gone into the little telephone booth, probably dating ourselves because not too many telephone booths out there anymore, but you put on that little Kevlar Superman outfit and you walk out, and the next thing you're impervious to anything that can happen. And that again, that's either attitudinal or department policy, or, you know, the fact that you shouldn't really be moving the rig, Mike. Isn't that correct? I mean, the standards kind of address that.
Right. The standard is very clear, Tom. The standard says that the apparatus operator cannot put the apparatus in any gear until the apparatus operator, him or herself, makes sure that everybody on board the apparatus is completely bunkered and dressed, sitting in an enclosed position with a seatbelt on. And you brought up a couple good points before, standing up inside the cab. And we've had numerous discussions with others, and the idea of putting raised roof cabs on fire trucks are there for one reason and one reason only, and that's to be able to stand up and get dressed. So the idea of having a raised roof cab on a particular apparatus just lends itself to this kind of fatalistic behavior of going down the road without a seatbelt on and just standing up and trying to get dressed in the name of time. And having done this work for a very long time, I can't remember of any fire that I went to that 30 seconds made a difference one way or the other, whether somebody lived or died. We constantly get in this rush mode of rush, 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 hurry, 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 and it ends up getting people hurt, mostly ourselves. And so that becomes an issue. The other thing that we learned when we were doing the seatbelt study, we had a bunch of experts in a room in Dallas at the Eye Chiefs a couple years ago, and nobody could really say with any degree of certainty that it's ever been written down of exactly how you're supposed to get dressed, in what order, and how you're supposed to respond. And there were a couple of choices that were put out there, but generally, from what I see, firefighters should get their complete bunker gear on. They should go to the apparatus after they have their bunker pants and their bunker coat on and buttoned and secured, sit down in the seat, and then put your SCBA straps on, and then finally your seatbelt. One of the things that I would teach when I taught rookie and probie firefighters is that I didn't want them to put their gloves on, that their gloves would rest on their lap, and so that when they exited the apparatus, while they were putting their gloves on, they could actually do a proper size up and understand what was on fire, where the fire was, what floor it was on, and how severe the fire was before they attempted interior operations. The big debate of late, you can go to Firefighters Close Calls website, there's been a discussion about what to do with helmets. It says in the standard that the only firefighters that need to be in fire helmets are those that are driving in fire apparatus that have completely open cab roofs. We know that there are some that still exist, but generally that's a part of history and they're antiques. And so there's no reason, and you shouldn't wear a helmet in a truck. If you think about it, when you sit in the SCBA seat with your back to the officer and you have a New Yorker style helmet, you realize that that big rear brim will actually take your neck up and off that cushion, and you could actually incur an injury with a helmet on a neck or a back injury that could be quite severe. And so the next then point of contention is, if you don't put your helmet on, which you should not, what do you do with it? Well, we need to have some way to affix it inside that crew cab so that the helmet itself doesn't become a projectile as well.
Good points, Mike, and that helmet issue is going to be addressed in the next edition of the 1901 standard, where they're going to come out and the language is going to be, you shouldn't be wearing your helmets inside the cab. They're not designed to be a crash helmet for crashworthiness protection. They're designed for head protection and structural firefighting. So our next couple of things on the seatbelt are kind of all related. And, Mike, I'm sure you had numerous experiences with this during your career in New York, but it's one thing to say you have a seatbelt policy. Our experience has been the majority of fire departments, certainly the majority of well-administered, active, busy running departments, everybody's got a seatbelt policy. But how does that policy get enforced? Our good friend and brother-in-arms, Billy Goldfeder, has had several good webcasts about this and a lot of good information up on firefighterclosecalls.com with respect to the difference between having a policy and have a policy that's enforced and understood, where the people understand that there are serious implications involved when you violate the seatbelt policy. So part of that is that you have to have a policy. It has to be clearly disseminated and understood by all of the individuals. You have to have officers. The person that's riding the right front seating position of the cab is just not along for the ride. Whether he's got one bar or two bars, or whether it's bars or axes, or you're an engine in a truck, we can make fun about it. It's all immaterial. The officer is responsible for enforcing that ultimately if he finds that individuals in his crew are not in compliance with that. And that creates another whole large dynamic within the fire service and the fire station environment of, you know, how you're perceived by your people, or whether you're the hard-nosed, the hardline guy. But it starts with a personal attitude, I believe, Mike, with respect to understanding that your safety is your responsibility, and if you're going to be stupid enough to attempt to violate the policy, then it's the company officer that's stepping in there, because otherwise people have just lost respect for the fact that the policy even exists. How do you deal with that?
At times it can be difficult. I know I've had my own struggles with my crew on the job as well. One of the things that Chief Goldfeder has professed of late is if you have a written policy and you don't enforce it, then get rid of it altogether. You need to have policies that you can enforce and not just provide lip service to. It's my recollection that this firefighter that fell out of the apparatus in Maryland was the third or fourth firefighter to fall out of a truck within the last half a dozen years. And one of the officials from that county wrote a very terse letter to all the employees of that county's fire service that this is really, really it. And then the next time, this is really, really, really it. You know, at some point, we don't like to, I don't, and most company officers and chief officers don't like to discipline firefighters, but it becomes a pretty stark choice. Do you want to discipline this firefighter and make an example of him and her so that everybody buckles up, and so that you as a company or chief officer are not knocking at their loved one's door at 3 in the morning and telling them that they are dead or seriously hurt because they failed to put a seatbelt on? The very safety equipment that's provided for us, we ignore and we don't use. And moreover, it was funny, the other morning I went into the firehouse and they had a pin job up on the Cross Bronx Expressway where a Ford Explorer went off of Jerome Avenue and fell down onto the roadway upside down. And one of the comments that were consistently made around the table was, if the guy had only been wearing a seatbelt, he probably would have made it. And I went on to say, I said, wow, that's amazing. I said, how many of you put a seatbelt on the way back to quarters? So it's okay for civilians to not wear seatbelts, and you can say that if they had, that they would have been saved, and yet you folks in the very business of providing public safety are acting in an unsafe manner by not putting your belts on.
Yep. Mike, that incident that you're, you know, we mentioned about in Prince George's County, Maryland, if you look back, and I'm always a little bit of a student of history with respect to apparatus design and just the traditions that sometimes were either worked in our favor or in many cases imperiled us to get us where we were. In that particular county, they started buying four-door, fully enclosed pumpers. They have a combination of mixed fleet by a bunch of different manufacturers. Some of the units purchased from the individual volunteer companies. Some of them purchased by the county themselves. But they started buying on a countywide basis, four-door cab apparatus, in 1986. And I remembered back in that era, it was still somewhat common, not universal, but somewhat common, to still be riding the tailboard. And it was the first locale that I had seen anywhere, at least out on the East Coast, that put large reflective signs on the back step, just above the rear compartment and in between where the rear discharges were, that said all riding on the rear step is prohibited. And the word prohibited was even in a larger font than the rest of that. And that stayed on the back tailboards because they were finally telling folks, in 1986, 5 years before the NFPA standard required it, and certainly long after other jurisdictions like New York had been doing four-door cabs, that was no longer legal by the department regulations to ride on the back step, because look forward, folks, we have now provided a four-door, fully enclosed cab with seating for six, and you should be up there. Well, the unit that this young firefighter in the Bladensburg Volunteer Fire Department fell out of was a county-owned unit, I believe, of a 90 or 91 vintage. So it's not like, you know, they've had four-door cabs in that jurisdiction for 22 years. And in 22 years, it's one thing if you're, you know, running around on a spare rig and you were trying to put your seatbelt on and somebody stuffed it underneath the seat cushion and you got to have to hunt and peck for it. But 22 years later, they're riding in four-door cab rigs. We still haven't gotten people to be seated and belted. And you're correct. I forget the total number of folks that have been injured by falling out of rigs in that. But if you're the fourth or fifth person that's done that in a period of time, I think that the gentleman, because I was copied on that email as well, as like the bottom was, I'm mad as hell, and we can't accept this anymore. I mean, sooner or later, we have to buck up and realize that it's part mechanical and that the seatbelt has to be provided and the cab environment has to be provided. In just about every jurisdiction we visited, people, the soup du jour is a four-door cab. It has a seatbelt, it has a shoulder belt, and yet we continue to do all these other things we talked about by keeping gear in the cab, by thinking that we should be dressing. It's okay to dress inside the cab, to go out and do some of these stupid things. And then you read about it, and as Mike said, that incident that he had in his own company, you know, they noted that the civilian, geez, if I had only put on my seatbelt, that would have worked, but it didn't. But that still wasn't enough to scare me or threaten me into wearing the seatbelt to come back from the run. You just you kind of have to wonder about things a little bit. So at any rate, we're going to take a break right now for a few minutes, and we'll be back. This is Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur live from San Diego at Firehouse World 2008.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Hi, and welcome back to a live Firehouse podcast, The Apparatus Architects, with Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur. We are live from Firehouse World in sunny San Diego, California for 2008. What do we have coming up in this part of the show, Tom?
Thanks, Mike. We're going to bring us back here. We're going to talk about the pending NFPA 1901 automotive fire apparatus changes that have been approved at the committee level, and all things appear that they will be publicly available and printed sometime in the late August, early September time frame. And for those people planning to purchase new apparatus of any description, customer, commercial, doesn't make any difference whose name or badge is on the front, all stars are aligned that this will take effect for contracts signed after January 1st of next year. So some rather significant changes, and as we go these rundowns, I know Brother Mike has written extensively in the past of the impact of custom chassis apparatus versus a commercial chassis apparatus, how they react during an accident, and for years there's been some recognition that depending upon make and model, if you compare one chassis to the other, there's going to be at least $35,000 to $40,000 difference between one chassis to the other, some case a little bit less, some case a little bit more. With some of the requirements that are coming down the road, Mike, on with the 1901 standard, it is certainly going to dramatically increase the cost of both chassis, but a little bit more possibly on the commercial side. So here are some of the things, and these, again, will be printed in black and white and available from the National Fire Protection Association sometime probably late August or early September. So here are some of the things that are going to be required on all fire apparatus acquired after that point. First is going to be a vehicle data recorder. Some people refer to this as the black box. This is going to be an event recorder that will monitor the apparatus operations, engine, and other activities going on, and will record them as the minimum to record on a 48-hour loop to have the date and the time, the engine speed, whether they had an ABS event, the wearing of all of the seat belts and people that were seated on the apparatus.
Well, when they were seated, what time they clicked in, what time they clicked out?
I don't know, Mike, that, again, this was the minimum standard, and they talked about the componentry that's out there currently that's used by commercial trucks in the commercial market and in other fleet applications, that there would certainly be some of those folks that would be bringing this equipment into our industry, into the emergency vehicle area, that would capture all of these things and possibly some more. But again, this is, as the 1901 standard is a minimum standard, these are the things that, as a baseline, it would have to record. To have the capacity of up to a minimum of 100 engine hours of operating time, the vehicle speed, vehicle braking, whether the emergency warning lights were activated or not. So as a minimum, vehicle data recorder. I'm sure a lot of our listeners are going to be interested to say, well, what impact does that have on the cost? Nobody really knows at this point. I'm sure the hardware will be out there in the marketplace sooner rather than later. A lot of the folks now recognizing that all of these things are now basically cast in granite and going to be part of the requirement. It would not surprise me, Mike, if during some of the upcoming shows that we'll be attending or other events that will be occurring on throughout our country, that you'll be able to start seeing this componentry out there and being advertised.
Before we go on there, I just had a couple questions on the black box. How do you think, Tom, that that's going to affect the manufacturing sector as it relates to warranties? And the second part of my question is, how do you think that will impact driver safety and lawsuits?
Well, the thing with respect to the apparatus and warranties, it may have some impact in that you'll no longer be in a position where the apparatus operator, the chauffeur, the engineer, if you get involved in a minor little fender bender, to tell the police, and obviously they can verify this through accident reconstruction techniques, to say that, you know, when you blew the stop sign, you hit her, but you had been applying the brakes and you entered the intersection at approximately 15 miles an hour. It's going to mitigate that because the black box is not going to lie. It's going to tell you exactly what speed you were going, whether you were applying the brakes. Many times people will say involved in accidents where there is some significant property damage to both the apparatus and the civilian vehicle or whatever they hit. You know, civilian would claim that, you know, lights and sirens weren't operating or the lights were on, but I didn't hear the vehicle. Well, it's going to take that all out of the mix because the vehicle data recorder, the black box, is not going to lie with respect to that. So that may have some impact in the warranty area. Where I would believe the more significant impact is going to come, that if you were doing everything right, this is going to prove you were in the right and is going to either potentially save you out of some very tough, long litigation that could be very expensive, or it's going to prove that you're not going to be able to lie anymore, you know, to be able to make up the scenario to make it fit the story that you'd like to tell the chief or like to tell the investigating police officer who's going to enter it into the report, or that if you find yourself on the other side of being deposed by an attorney to say, you know, Mr. Wilbur, when you entered the intersection, you know, at 47 miles an hour against a red light at 3:30 in the morning, you know, why were you doing that? You know, so I think it's going to have some impacts there. The hope would be that fire departments would use this as an effective training tool and not to be used as the big hammer to come down on folks when somebody does something that's inappropriate, to be used it for retribution against drivers. As we all know, driving, Brother Mike has written for years about the topic, driving an emergency vehicle can be a rather exhilarating experience, but you also are putting yourself and your crew at great peril and risk if you frankly go out there and operate without due regard to safety and run around like a cowboy. And if you're the kind of guy, I guess it was a couple years ago that the I related this to some stories, and Mike had been teaching some EVOC classes and was talking about some stories that you just absolutely couldn't make up the scenario, but they were true and truthful, and where people were seriously injured or killed, and it really didn't have any impact on the vehicle operator at all. He went back out and had the same bad habits, you know, the next shift he came back and didn't change anything. Well, these kind of guys that want to ride around and be cowboys, I'm sure it won't be too long for once this hardware, and this hardware is going to be retrofittable. So I would think that it's, you know, once people see the benefit of this, this would be something like, I can recall back somewhat showing my age here, that, you know, was the early to mid 60s was the very first time I started seeing people removing the back seat cushions out of jump seats in apparatus and said, well, let's put the SCBA there. Let's get the SCBA out of the box. Let's put it in, you know, the Zyko bracket that's now been out in the marketplace, or whatever brand of bracket you use, for 40-plus years. And I can vividly remember a volunteer chief in an upstate New York department that I had joined after leaving the great state of Maryland. And the chief said, well, we can't destroy the seat by removing the seat back. That wouldn't be right. So what are you supposed to do, like wait till the next time you get the fire truck? Well, I think the vehicle data recorder, Mike's going to be much in the same thing. Once people see the benefit of this and the fact it can help you during an accident and help you from getting jammed up. If you're doing everything right, this is going to prove that you were in the right. So the second item impacts everything, and where we know, Mike, what's probably the most dangerous fire truck out there? We're not talking about a brand of fire truck, but if I'm running around and I got a good chance of rolling over, what kind of rig am I driving?
Okay, we're driving some kind of tender or mobile water supply apparatus or a pumper with a large booster tank.
So, as we all know, for the last several years, there's been an innumerable number of fatalities on second, third line tankers or tenders that were originally an oil tanker and converted, or homemade units or whatever. At a recent Fire Department Safety Officers Association apparatus symposium that I attended, one of the presenters was talking specifically about tanker safety, and he had some pictures of stuff from the middle part of the country that would just, if you had hair on your head, it would make you stand up. Just that you can't believe that people were running around, frankly, in crap like this. So the next thing is a roll stability test. You either need to tilt table test every vehicle that you produce or every model of like variants up to 26.5 degrees, or you can calculate the stability up to 28 degrees, or the standard will allow you to have a stability control system. So this is now finally going to attack the problem that we have of, you're not going to be able, even if you're buying a new fire truck with an unlimited budget, you're not going to see, hopefully in the future, some department try to outdo the next door neighboring department by putting a 4,000-gallon water tank with a double high side bodies with ladders through the water tank and everything else, with this vehicle having an overall height of 128 inches, and then you get to the hose bed and think that that vehicle is going to be safe. It may or may not be safe. You're either going to have to tilt table test that to 26.5 degrees, which means that, and the people that build ARF units and over in Europe, they've done this for years. This, for us here in the States, is going to be new technology. Third thing is going to be requiring a tire pressure monitoring system. It's a little surprising to me, and I was very taken aback by some of the commentary that came out of that conference that I just mentioned that I attended earlier this month, that the number of pieces of apparatus that were involved in pretty serious motor vehicle accidents, and they found one of the attendant causes was underinflated, if not flat, tires, particularly on duals. So new apparatus in the future, combination of this and the next thing with the maximum top speed. Right now, the NFPA standard, I believe, says that fire trucks have to go a minimum of 55 miles an hour. If you contact any new fire truck builder and they build up a spec for you, the minimum speed that gets spit out of the computer system, it starts at 65. So that generally invokes the question to the fire chief or the apparatus committee, how fast do you want this vehicle to go? And I'm surprised that you get in some pretty lively discussions, about as lively if somebody has changing the color scheme of their rigs and leaving the world that horrid lime green color and going to change it to anything else. The discussion of what color to paint the fire truck gets about as lively as saying, well, how fast do you want this vehicle to go? And this also relates to the tanker scenario. So this, the standard is going to have in the future, and I believe I have this information correct, if the gross vehicle weight rating of the unit is between 26,000 pounds and 50,000 pounds, max speed is 68 miles an hour, or the maximum speed that the tire is rated for. And if the vehicle is over 50,000 pounds, it's going to be 60 miles an hour, or the maximum top speed that the tire is rated for. And this is where you get into problems. You can have people inadvertently mess up and say, I want the vehicle to go 70 to 72 miles an hour, which, if you're in a tight urban area, that's probably too fast. If you're out traversing the highways in Nebraska or Montana and you've got 20 or 25-mile runs on interstate highway to get to different points, then, you know, that might be an appropriate speed. But where people get jammed up, Mike, is that they'll spec a top speed and then not look at or address the brand, make, and model and the speed rating of the tire they're putting on. And in the fire service, where we get some freebies here, well, we can take a tire that is nominally rated to carry, for example, 30,000 pounds and is speed rated at 72 miles an hour, they'll allow us that same tire to be used on a fire truck because it's considered to be a limited duty or not a continuous duty application, and have that tire rated to carry 31,000 pounds, a series of four tires on the back end, to carry 31,000 pounds, the same tire that in the commercial service would be rated at 30, but then we have to limit the speed of that tire. So there's going to be heightened emphasis now placed, obviously, if you look at the whole tire scenario. And again, are we putting a Band-Aid on things? Well, probably to a point, because we've now recognized, because we're being honest with ourselves, what's causing these accidents. These rigs just don't launch and roll over because it's an act of God. You know, I got stuck in an airport coming out here a couple days ago because of fog. That's an act of God. If you take a fire truck and overspeed the unit, or take a unit that's capable of doing 75 to 77 miles an hour, but have tires on there that are speed rated for 65, you're designing a problem. So that's, again, one of the other items. Most importantly, this is kind of interesting. One of the other things the standard is going to require, because this had kind of been alluded to in the past but kind of gotten glossed over. On delivery, if I am delivering, Mike, in the future, a brand new fire truck to the Michael K. Wilbur Fire Department, I am going to have to supply you with a typewritten list of the things of the 1901 exceptions. If there was anything within the confines of the standard from the front to the back that I'm not supplying or not doing, I need to tell you that, and it's got to be signed by both the manufacturer and the customer. So no more of these little cutting corners, for example, where I've still seen it occasionally. Somebody says, I got to have my air horns on the roof. Why? I don't care about the 1901 standard. I'll sign a waiver. Yeah, not going to be able to do that stuff anymore. For the fire chief that says, you know, I've got a contract with Brand X tire and that speed rated for 65, but don't worry, I still want my fire truck to do 72 miles an hour. Not going to be able to do that. So some loose equipment things. Not that these are big items, but things that the new 1901 standard is going to require. Every piece of fire apparatus to carry an AED, to carry safety vests, one for each of the riding positions, to carry a minimum of 5 traffic cones or 5 highway safety devices, something you can use to identify the fact if you're operating out in the public domain, out on the street, so that you can safely cordon off an area. And in the future, they're no longer going to require, and this goes back to way back to the National Board of Fire Underwriters in the 50s that ISO had adopted for years, that you needed to carry, the number's going to remain the same, of 4 handline nozzles, but it used to be you had to carry 2 combination nozzles, which we would all know today as automatic nozzles, and in most cases, an automatic fog nozzle of some description, and 2 smoothbore nozzles. It just, the new standard is going to just say, got to carry 4 handline nozzles, and they're going to have a gallon per minute flow requirement. So next item drastically impacts fire apparatus design, as well as how we have finally beginning to envision, thanks to a lot of good work that Mike and some other people behind the scenes have done with respect to the whole seatbelt initiative. And this is that, as they've obviously scanned the number of firefighters up to this point, that the NFPA standard for weight allowance for personnel, if you had a pumper or a ladder truck and had seating for 6, the old standard would require that you had to have allow 200 pounds per person. The new standard is going to finally come to grips with the fact that 200 pounds in an average firefighter in bunker gear was severely underestimated, that the new weight requirement is going to be 250 pounds. Now, people would say, well, you know, like big deal, what's that mean? Well, let's take your commercial cabin chassis, all right, that has seating for 5 guys, pretty standard, 4 in SCBA seats and a driver's seat. Well, that might have an impact on that lower end economy model pumper that you purchased, because now if you got seating for 5, well, that other 50 pounds together with everything else you're pulling or shoving into the front of the cab can have an impact. Going to have an impact, believe it or not, more so, Mike, on aerial apparatus design, where we've got these massive tower ladders, particularly the rear mount towers, where we've got 21.5 or 22,000 pound front axles, and they're running right on the ragged edge, and you get one of those with seating for 6 or seating for 8, that's another 300 to 400 pounds that we're adding up on the front end, in addition to the fact that with the 2007 engine emissions, that power plant together with the diesel particulate filter, all of that has added weight to the front axle as well. So in the future, you're going to have to unfortunately see on both commercial cabs and chassis, but certainly on commercial and custom cabs and chassis, you're going to see heavier front axles on these vehicles to compensate for a combination of the fact of the heavier components on the front end and the fact that we've got to calculate 250 pounds per person to get in there. So that's a quick summary of some of the major things that are being offered up with the new 1901 standard. All of them, we feel very confident, are going to improve and should be able to enhance safety, Mike. The other thing it's clearly going to do, going to raise the price of poker here. It's going to...
How much do you feel that it may potentially raise the price of a unit, say from a low number to a high number?
You know, Mike, at this point, that question was asked of several different presenters at some of the conferences so far this year. Nobody really has a handle on it, and I'm not dodging the question here, but until we come out and get some hard cost numbers on the componentry, for example, the vehicle data recorder in the roll stability area. Some of the manufacturers that build apparatus currently already have tilt tables. Not a big deal. So, but if you don't own a tilt table and you're going to have to go construct or go buy one or decide that you're going to calculate the stability or go to a stability control system, that's going to have a, you know, could have a sizable impact on the vehicle. Just off the top guess, I could easily see this just with the other enhanced safety componentry on there, probably easily going to add another $4,000 to $5,000 to the average cost of the unit moving forward. And as we get further on into this calendar year, the componentry becomes commercially available, and we see what the parts are going to cost to get it installed there. You'll probably have a better idea. But
This is going to affect the price of 2009 units, and then right on the cusp of that, we have the 2010 new emission standards. Is that correct?
That's correct. So you'd be looking at for each of the next couple of years, and this is where some folks got jammed up when they were planning an apparatus purchase and got caught up in the 2007 engine emissions, and they had set their budget in 2006. The process took longer, or the bidding process took longer, or whatever happened, and they ended up bidding the unit and having the manufacturers bid an 07 engine versus a pre-07 engine. And the cost of that componentry alone, depending upon who you dealt with, was worth $8,000 to $14,000, plus the normal cost of inflation with apparatus. And there's been an awful lot said on with all the talking heads and the pundits out there of where our country is headed globally with respect to a recession and the impact on inflation. I can tell you that certainly looks like, from what's going on in the industry, look just recently with the announcement that American LaFrance made about filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, that is certainly, we're hoping that that's not what's going to happen to a lot of other builders, but it shouldn't be any surprise to most of our more astute listeners that the apparatus industry, while the business has been good in that in the past couple of years there's been a lot of people buying, there's a lot of people buying, Mike, but there's not a lot of people that are in the apparatus industry that are making money or making sufficient money to keep the owners and or the investors pleased with their financial performance. So moving forward, where traditionally the price of fire apparatus has gone up pretty much in line with where the rate of inflation has been, with the high cost of raw materials, particularly in the metals area, with the continuing increasing cost of labor, look at the cost of what, you know, we're paying for when I go out with my wife every Saturday to go grocery shopping. We come in and I forget what product we picked up. I just happen to buy brand. I like a particular brand of breakfast cereal. Well, the price of that thing, only because I kind of paid attention to it, you know, it jumped up like 80 cents in the last month. Well, you take that, and whether you want to go blame it's because of some political affiliation, which is kind of ludicrous, but it's got more to do with, you know, the cost of petroleum-based products in general. What we're paying for gasoline and everything has an impact on an awful lot of things we buy. So my perspective would be, and I hope I'm proven wrong here, I'd rather be proven wrong than proven right with this, that where traditionally we've expected fire apparatus to go up like 3.5% to maybe 4% per annum, I think you better plan that just from a normal pace of inflation, that's going to be greater moving forward. And that together with the cost of, you know, the other consumables that we're buying, the other things we want to put on the apparatus, and as such, it's frankly probably going to get worse before it gets better. So plan for that.
Well, you brought up the financial situation of some of these builders, and we're pretty confident to know that there are only a handful that are actually making money at building fire apparatus. So with that said, would it be some good advice for our listeners as they prepare bid packages to go out to bid to require a Dun & Bradstreet and a bid bond and a performance bond? Could you speak to those, Tom?
Well, yeah, you certainly want to be confident that the manufacturer you're dealing with, you could be dealing with the local dealership and the salesperson in a local dealership that maybe you went to high school with and best friends forever. You need to look deeper than that and the relationship you're going to have with the local salesperson and the dealership. You need to deeply, as Mike alluded to, look into the financial stability of the company that you're going to buy the fire truck from. If you're buying the fire truck, it's a long-term investment, kind of like your car, but to the power of eight. Now, you buy a car that's got a 3-year, 36,000-mile warranty, there's a reasonable chance that car company is still going to be in business at the end of the warranty period. You buy a fire truck, Mike, let's take a ladder truck, all right? And you're buying a ladder truck, and you're going to buy an extended warranty for 3 years for the whole rig, bumper to bumper. And with that warranty package, you get a 7-year paint warranty, and the salesman touts you have a 10-year structural warranty on the body and cab and a 15-year structural warranty on the aerial device. Well, you probably want to make sure that if you're ponying up $800,000 to $1 million, those people are going to be around to support that warranty for the life of the vehicle. So requesting a Dun & Bradstreet financial rating so that you can see and check the financial performance of the company to certainly require a bid bond, but more importantly, a performance bond, so that once you enter into the contract with the company, you can be assured that these people are going to faithfully produce the vehicle, or the bonding company steps in. And with some of the conversations that both Mike and I have had with folks most recently, friends and people that have just contacted us saying, I've got the American LaFrance on order, what should I do? Well, it only kind of becomes a go, no-go situation. If you have a performance bond, at least you have the backing of the bonding company that's going to assure that something's going to happen positively. It may delay the vehicle until the company can financially get reorganized and get back on their feet. There were folks, and it got had written up nationally, that had purchased rigs from a company that was went out of business where they just padlocked the door, New Lexington, and these poor folks had paid money up front in good faith, exchanged funds to pay for a commercial chassis, and never had the chassis and never had the MSO or the title transferred over to them, and were simply out the money. So you certainly don't want to get involved in situations like that. So to finish up today with just a couple thoughts, that what can you do if you're a consumer, you're going out in the marketplace, and you're going to be buying a new pumper? You know, what can you do to maybe make sure you get what you pay for, but more importantly, you identify the value that you're getting on those units? Mike and I, over the course of the last several years, all the articles we've written, Apparatus Architect, have tried to influence or at least counsel folks to say, you need to buy something that's going to work for your community. Don't buy it because the guy next door to you bought it. Don't get it because you saw it in a magazine or a show, looked great on a display floor, and then got it in town and found out it didn't work at all.
And don't buy it if a salesman comes into town with a demo unit and promises delivery tomorrow. Don't get snookered into that. You need to be able to design appropriate apparatus for your jurisdiction and get it manufactured and delivered in a timely fashion. You don't want to buy a pre-built apparatus that may not necessarily be sufficient for your jurisdiction's needs and then have to live with this nightmare for the next 25 or 30 years. We see that over and over again.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's times that, you know, if you find yourself that you have a determined need, you have budget monies allocated, you're going to be buying a rig, just some thoughts. You can always go old school, write the specs and do all that. But here's some quick ideas and things just maybe that you can save money. Find out if you're going to talk to two or three different vendors. Find out if they have any major contracts or units on order that you might be able to tag on to where these units meet 80 to 90% of what your requirements are. And in a lot of cases with the major manufacturers, they have long-term multi-year contracts, three-year, four-year, five-year contracts with some major jurisdictions to supply them apparatus. That apparatus might have, if it does have some of the same features and benefits that you're looking for to purchase on your rig, you frankly don't need to reinvent the wheel. You may be able to tag on to that advertised price. You already know what the cost of admission is initially, and you might be able to make modifications and changes to that spec to get it more closely to what you would want to do if you'd want to do it from scratch. So that's one thing, Mike. The second thing Mike mentioned about, don't get snookered into just having somebody show up, and this happens a lot of time with aerial apparatus. I think these people are like lambs out in a large open farm area, and we just let a pack of wolves on them, right? First-time aerial purchaser doesn't know a whole lot about what they're looking for. They get stock units to come in there, and the local salesperson obviously has an interest in selling you something, obviously has interest in selling you something real fast, says, this is the rig for you. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I can just tell you from our track record in history, there have been a number of times Mike and I have surveyed a community and recommended, not by brand or model, because that's not what we're about, recommend a type of apparatus. For example, a mid-mount tower ladder without a pump would be what you folks need, and they end up buying a rear mount tower that's a quint because they could get it tomorrow, you know, the quick need, and that may or may not be the best situation for you. But at any rate, if you find yourself really jammed up, you've wrecked a rig, you need something quick, or you have very low expectations, right? Maybe for a department that has, for example, has always owned commercial chassis apparatus, they had $270,000 saved up to buy a custom chassis rig. They find out pretty shortly with everything they wanted to put on that rig that $270,000 is not going to cover it. There are different manufacturers that offer program units. They're units that have limited options. Instead of having everything in the catalog available, they have maybe 15 or 20% of what's available in the catalog.
Did some of the companies out there create custom apparatus, Tom, to kind of compete with the lesser expensive commercial apparatus so that they didn't lose market share?
Yeah, part of it was that, that the larger builders have recognized that the market for 100% purely high custom rigs, that market's shrinking every year, all right? Once you get past the large cities, the number of individual communities that can afford $450,000 to $500,000 for a fire truck, they're out there, but they're kind of few and far between. So the program unit gets everything. The majority of the highly requested options, they're pre-engineered, so we're not starting from a fresh sheet of paper every time, normally at pretty attractive pricing, and sometimes the delivery terms, you know, you can get these in 6 to 8 months. You don't necessarily have to wait for a year. Although if you have to wait for a year, this rig's going to be around for 15 or 20. You should never make a purchasing decision unless you're jammed up, all right, to say, I can get the rig 60 days quicker.
Well, and even if you become jammed up, say you had a horrific accident with the apparatus and it was totaled out, there's certainly a good selection of used apparatus out there, or there are also companies that would lease you an apparatus in the interim until you could get a replacement vehicle. There's absolutely no reason for anybody out there to have to buy stock rigs and rush into a purchase. There are other remedies out there that you can attain to prevent that kind of salesmanship and high-pressure buying that some are doing.
Yeah. And our last thought is, and this is something that might seem to be extreme, but I think it has great value. It's not uncommon to our listeners, if you have an apparatus committee, it's got five or six people all come to the table with one or two components that they really want to put on the rig, and they're going to be pretty persistent until they get that component on there. Well, unfortunately, in today's market, the day of the $330,000 to $350,000, again, we're talking about custom chassis pumpers here, is almost gone. I'm almost numb that it was several years ago and I heard about a $500,000 pumper, you know, straight Class A pumper, and thought, wow, that's a lot of money. Now, a lot of cases, it's almost commonplace. And we're not talking about rigs that come equipped with radios and all that stuff. It's just like the rig's for it, 98, and by the time you put the stuff on it that you want, you know, we're well over $500,000. And a lot of people, frankly, to our listeners, they can't afford that. So the thought is to spec out the basic unit for something, the pump, the tank, the body material and the body configuration, and the engine and transmission, the horsepower and pump combination that's going to need to meet your community's needs. And before you get into all the other nice little bells and whistles, is it nice to put a Class A foam system on a rig? Absolutely. Is it nice to put a hydraulic generator and a light tower on there? That's fine as well. But you take those three components, and if you buy a middle-of-the-road foam system, a middle-of-the-road hydraulic generator, 10 kW, and a modest light tower, you've just spent another $35,000 to $40,000. Well, if you only had $400,000 budgeted and you needed to buy radios and some equipment with the rig, and a rig comes in at $389,000, you know that's not happening. So our thought is, spec out the basic rig. You can do this in our bullet list type format. Send it out to the vendor, say, give me a ballpark price, plus or minus $15,000, $20,000 for this rig, and ask for those other components that you would want, but ask for them as options. So, for example, if you're really in a tight budget, are aluminum wheels nice on apparatus and LED warning lights? Absolutely. But if you're up against a tight budget, option that. Certainly, if you're entertaining the thought of any kind of foam system, option that so you can clearly see what that costs, and then you can make the determination if you're in a tight budget situation what you can afford versus what you can't afford. What's happening more often than not, to wrap up, Mike, is that we've worked with folks, gave them a budget range of what they would want, what they need to get on the rig for what they're looking for. They go through the spec process. The price of the vehicle goes up. They want to throw more options on it, more options, more options. The cost of the vehicle finally gets so high that now they don't have enough money to buy the vehicle. They bid it, and even the lowest bidder is $15,000, $20,000, pick a number, $30,000 above what they got budgeted, and now they've spent all this time. They're frustrated because now they think they can't get anything, and they go back to the local financial folks and say, can we get some more money? Answer today, absolutely not. It's not welcome, Chief Wilbur. Sure, we'll give you another $50,000. It's, I gave you $400,000. Get the heck out of my office. And people have wasted, in a lot of cases, 9-10 months developing the specs and have everything in the kitchen sink on a vehicle and just don't have enough money to buy it.
Well, that's like when we go out and do consulting, that we have what we call the list of 10. And when we get the truck committee together, we ask each one of them to write down the 10 things that this apparatus has to have. If it doesn't have it, it's a deal breaker. We don't want the apparatus. And that could be anything from the kind of engine or transmission to the tank and pump size and maybe hose bed configuration and layout, if it's an aerial, the size and type of that. And then we have the 10 list of things that would be nice to have if funds are available. And I think those are the things that you're speaking of, Tom, where we would certainly want to price those out as on the bid sheet as an add-on and get a price for that and find out if those 10 things that everybody on the truck committee would like to have are within financial reach.
Absolutely, Mike. And then the last thing is that if you're going to be wanting to get equipment on there, you know, a lot of departments now, the term is, we want to have this turnkey. We want it to come into town. We want to, you know, throw water in a tank, hose in a hose bed, that, and put our SCBAs in the seats, and that's it. So if you're looking to get, you know, radio equipment, you know, or MDTs or other high-end expensive electronic equipment, again, it's great to have the vehicle come through with that. The dealers are going to be responsible in many cases for doing it at their end on a local level. They're going to have to buy it sometimes, and if the vehicle's late, they're going to have to inventory it. They're going to have to pay for it and have the carrying charges. It doesn't come for free. In a lot of jurisdictions, they think we need to buy the vehicle complete because we don't have a funding stream for all this other stuff. But when you add all this stuff up in there, it's costing somebody money. It's costing you, the consumer, money, and it's stuff that you need. But ask for it to, you know, you can still put it in with all the details and the specs, but put it at the back, option them out individually so that you can pick and choose. And then it's kind of like the Chinese menu. You don't get jammed up where it's the fixed price dinner that you either get everything for that price, but if you don't want something, well, I'm sorry, you know, I don't want dessert. Sorry, we don't discount the meal $5.95 because you didn't want dessert and coffee. It's $42.95. Enjoy. So that's to kind of wrap up what we're doing. So at any rate, if you have any questions that you'd like Michael or I to answer in future podcasts, send them in to podcast@firehouse.com. We'll be happy to answer those and entertain those on the air. Mike, any parting thoughts?
Yeah, we'd be remiss if we didn't thank our sponsors, Task Force Tips, for again sponsoring this episode, and it looks like they're going to continue to sponsor us. So we appreciate the efforts of Task Force Tips to continue advertising and helping to fund the Apparatus Architect series. So we want to thank those folks.
So we'd like to wrap up by thanking everyone for listening to this episode of the Apparatus Architects podcast, and it's saying goodbye. Please stay safe out there to all the brothers and sisters. From Mike Wilbur and Tom Shand here live at San Diego at Firehouse World 2008.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these, or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.